In pretty much the course we designed for Psy last year, so we already tried it once. The people that originally taught it were Matt Choptwick, Franz Pretorius, and myself. Both Franz and Matt have had some personal problems that have prevented them from coming here. Maybe Matt might be able to come towards the last week, we still don't know. But so I'll be covering two-thirds of it, and Scott Noble, also a collaborator of us at different levels, so we're going to be covering the second week. There is a web page for the course where everything is in there. We're going to organize things with respect to the course and the tutorials and the labs in such a way that in the afternoon we're going to have also some heavy involvement with also tutorials as far as it refers to numerical computations themselves. It's impossible for us to require you or to ask any project that will involve you writing a big code or even a minor code, because that will suck up a lot of your energy and distract from the end goal. So what we have instead is a simple program, and this is something that you guys install in your machines, and those that have still problems, please see me that we need to fix that, that will, with very simple instructions, generate the code for you. So you're going to be completely agnostic as far as writing the code. That would be taken care of automatically. And the only thing you have to learn is how to go into some basic file that this code needs to read from to generate the code and know how to modify that. So for all intents and purposes, it's like you were using Maple, just typing a set of instructions, punching a number, and at the end of the day, this code gets generated. So you're going to interact with the code very little. You're just going to be interacting more with the kind of front-end file and the results. And from there, we'll learn how to go about trying to get a numerical solution. So let me just go down. This is next. Okay, so the course outline is the following. So the first week, we're going to be discussing mostly just the solution of classical field equations. And we're going to concentrate on just one particular technique, which is a technique called finite differences. I'll tell you a little bit more about them as we go along, and compare them with the other techniques, and why is it that we choose, in particular, to start with finite differences. So we could go very rigorous at the very beginning and mark things into rigorous applied mathematics or mathematical techniques, but the way we're going to approach is we're going to go in the opposite way. We're going to concentrate on a very simple example first and climb up the ladder from there. And so as we go along, we're going to introduce further and further, if you want, rigorous analysis. But to begin with, we're going to start very simple. So we're going to discuss mainly today, how to approach a numerical problem, assuming the numerical problem is well-defined. And these are things that we're going to be rigorous or we're going to explain more as we go along. Then we're going to talk maybe tomorrow or the day after tomorrow about Einstein's equations, which a priori don't even give you a well-defined mathematical problem as far as you knowing the state of the system now or your space-time, the space-time around you at this very moment, and you want to know what the space-time is going to be like tomorrow. Einstein's equations don't tell you a priori how to do that. We are going to have to find a way to discuss how to set it in a way that is going to be convenient for us. In particular, then, we're going to talk about the applications into the simplest problem we can think about, which is going to be, again, in three space-time dimensions plus a time direction. And we're going to just think of the spherically symmetric problem. And we're going to discuss just evolutions or how to go about trying to understand how some simple fields will behave on a curved spacetime. And that will tie to the behavior of quasi-normal modes of black holes and things that you can use to test the spacetime curvature, assuming the spacetime curvature doesn't vary. The second week, we're going to kind of switch gears, and this is going to be covered mostly by Scott, is realize that once you're studying equations like Einstein's equations, Maxwell's equations, et cetera, but you're looking at hydrodynamics, some of the things we discussed today, we're going to have to be careful with and modify the particular techniques we'll introduce, because hyperbolic equations will be divided actually in two different families, and depending on which family we're talking about, there are new phenomena that we're going to have to worry about, in particular this phenomena of shocks. that we'll have to deal in an appropriate manner. And the last week, we're going to kind of go forward. We're going to go into discussing things as of current research, how you go about trying to understand a very highly dynamical scenario and what it entails to go after them. So we'll talk about those later. Just as a few, there's a few references here where you can read about these techniques, and as you go down in the list, you're going to get you're getting more and more rigorous. In some, in many ways, the fathers of rigorous mathematical analysis in the last few decades are these three gentlemen here, Gustav von Kreis and Oliger. Pretty much, they have developed many of the techniques that are involved in trying to understand time-dependent problems. Okay, so let me just say some. This is annoying. Let me just. I'm going to move this thing this way. Have a little bit more room. Okay, so let me just start with the things we're going to assume. So we're going to assume that we're addressing or trying to find solutions, general solutions of a problem that is defined by some time-dependent partial differential equations. So we're going to have at the level, say, of the action, some classical field equations defined by whatever Lagrangian we might have. And somehow, and these are things that we'll discuss as we go along, we end up with a time-dependent partial differential of equations to solve. We're going to then, once we have those equations, we're going to have to find ways to iterate them numerically. But even before doing that, we have to have a good understanding of the system that we have in our hands. So by that I mean we even have to have the, not the suspicion, but the belief, and we'll discuss more about this as we go along, that the problem that we're trying to solve numerically makes sense, and even from the mathematical point of view. So we're going to assume that we can define something that's called an initial value problem, or initially a boundary value problem, and we'll make the distinction in a second, where we can say, or through different ways, or we can be convinced that the problem will have, at even the analytical level, a decent solution. That means if we can prescribe the state of the system at some given time, it makes sense to try to get what the final time will be, or what the solution will be at some later time. The difference between the initial value problem and the initial boundary value problem is where we have to worry about boundaries or not. So for most or for many applications, say either because we have no boundaries, say we're dealing with a cosmological problem where the space-time is closed, there are no boundaries, we can assume there is periodicity in the extra dimension. Therefore, we don't need to give or worry about boundary conditions. Or in the R1, where we have, we're assuming we're solving things with respect to a box or in a finite domain there, in order to specify at the formal level the problem, in order to have a unique solution, we need to give the initial state of the system plus appropriate boundary conditions that define a unique solution at the end of the day. So this is going to be a problem that will be a big concern for us, because even when perhaps we were dealing with a problem that has boundaries at infinity, and therefore we don't have to worry about the boundaries, in practice, due to finite computational resources, we're going to have to chop it off and find a local solution. And therefore, understanding the boundaries will be a crucial piece of setting up the problem in the right way. But we're going to begin the discussion kind of more in this level, just to worry about the basic considerations, and then we're going to bring the boundaries in. So we're going to have a working definition that says, essentially, that the initial an initial value problem, given some set of partial differential equations, corresponds to prescribing or knowing which partial differential equations govern the dynamics of our system, provide appropriate initial conditions for us to be able to evolve in time and obtain a solution at a later time. By the way, I mean, just ask as many questions as you need, I mean, or as you want. This, the idea is that this is more of a dialogue than anything else. So this is the basic setup that we have in the back of our minds. And we are trying to get a solution of a general problem. But before going into the numerics, let me just say that the discussions we just said is generic. So even whatever way you might want to have in order to have obtain a final solution to the problem, let me just discuss some examples. So typically, when you're dealing with a complicated problem or complicated system, say Einstein's equations, the typical way of finding particular solutions of that problem has been to try to simplify those very messy equations in as much as you can. As a result, you consider problems that have some symmetry. This is, for instance, what you do to find Schwarz's solution. You assume that there is the stationarity, that there is a full spherical symmetry in the problem, and you end up with a more manageable system of equations, so then you can solve in closed form, and you find some solutions. The problem, of course, of that, a shortcoming of that, is that the solutions that you find are restricted to the symmetries that you assume, and therefore are not generic. Another method is to assume that the system can be expanded in a perturbative fashion. You understand a particular solution, say even Schwarz's solution, and you're trying to find out what happens in a dynamical scenario now to try to understand what happened with perturbations on Schwarzschild, and then you want to know how those behave. So you introduce some perturbative parameter, some smallness parameter, and then you just do a linearized approximation or a second order approximation. You just expand your equations with respect to this background solution. And your control parameter is this small parameter that you introduce. For instance, the energy of the perturbation that you are using to perturb the black hole is very, very small, and then you're perturbing with respect of that. But of course, the solution that you obtain is only valid up to or during the scenario, the stages where that parameter stays small. You know that you can put an arbitrary small density of energy and make it collapse in such a way that, for instance, it will go from flat space-time to a black hole space-time. And of course, if you're approximating everything with respect to flat space-time plus a perturbation, that will break out at some point when you're forming the black hole, because then it doesn't make any sense to regard things with respect to a flat metric. So that the perturbative approach is an approach that makes sense as long as the perturbative parameter can be controlled is small. And again, it has as a shortcoming that you can only probe so far. You can only probe situations where that parameter is small. The one we're going to use is the numerical approach is where you say, I'm going to introduce another parameter, another small parameter, and things are going to be, the solution we'll obtain will be accurate or be a good representation of a true solution as long as that smallness parameter makes sense. Our smallness parameter will be the discretization length of the spacetime. Whatever we introduce, we have a continuous spacetime, we're going to chop it off and discretize it in a particular way, which we'll discuss. And as a result, we have a solution to a different problem. We're going to have a solution to a discretized problem. But we have full control. In principle, if you are able to take smaller and smaller discretization lengths, you're going to approach better and better the final solution or the solution you really want to get out. Yes?
How do you make those?
Right, so that's a great question. And we're getting to questions like that in just a second. It will depend on what is it that you're trying to do. So what you have in your, it depends on what particular question you're trying to address. If you're trying to address, for instance, how does the vicinity of the black hole behave as you perturb it, and you're interested mainly in the qualitative behavior of the black hole as you perturb it, then you don't need to put the boundaries too far. I mean, you're only interested in what happens in the vicinity of the black hole. However, if the question is now, okay, I want to perturb the black hole, I want to find out what happens at the vicinity of the black hole and how that dynamical behavior gets translated into some radiation that you're going to produce and it's going to propagate out and an observer will see, then we're in trouble. Now you have to be able to put the boundaries sufficiently far out so that you can place observers at some distance that will be measuring this radiation. And as we'll discuss later on, the very fact that we don't have control on the boundaries will make that will make you have to put the boundary even further out, because the boundaries, by necessity, will have some, will introduce some influence in the problem, but you want an answer that is independent of the boundary influence, so you're going to have to put it even further out. But these are issues that will come in. And at the end of the day, and this is something one of the things we want to drive home here, is that we want to make sure that you know what are the basic criteria by which you're going to be able to say, this is a solution and this is why I trust it. And that will require several criteria. You're going to have to show that as you decrease the resolution of your grid, as you put more and more points, the solution stays qualitatively the same, and quantitatively, it goes to the final solution in a very prescribed manner. We're going to teach how you're going to be going about trying to understand this. And also, if you move some physical, arbitrarily introduced parameters, like the location of the outer boundary, by changing it at different locations and showing that the solution still doesn't change, then you can give further evidence that your final solution is the correct one. Okay, so this is kind of the philosophy we have. We have a control parameter. Our control parameter is the space in between the grids. If we have a larger or a big enough machine at our disposal, we can always make it smaller and make sure we're getting consistent results. Or if we work harder, and these are some of the techniques we'll also discuss towards the last week, you can be smarter as how you place these points, how do you discretize your system, and ensure that your error, and this is also something we want you to learn, how to estimate the error in your solution. You're going to be able to bring the error down in a controlled manner so as to guarantee that the solution you obtain is the correct one. And the main point at the end of the day is that a priori, this system or this way of attacking the problem is completely general. It does not rely on you knowing a particular background solution, and with respect to that background solution, looking at how perturbations behave. You can attack, in principle, any problem that you care to attack. And if you do the right job, you're going to get the solution. The one problem, though, is that every numerical solution will produce one solution. While when you're doing the perturbative approach, for instance, you can study a whole family of solutions that are depending on this perturbative parameter. Here, you're going to extract one solution every time you run your code. So the idea of having this numerical or going about obtaining these numerical solutions is, well, in some sense, obtaining the solution, but more importantly, getting enough intuition out of the solution that you obtain that will give you a completely new way of, or perhaps a completely new set of things you can think about, and then go back at the problem, perhaps even at this analytical or semi-analytical way, using the intuition that the numerical solution gave you, and maybe you can extract now a behavior that is generic, not just with respect to a particular solution. And there are plenty of examples of people going with the numerics, finding out that the system behaves in a very particular way, for instance, the system might behave in a self-similar way, then using the fact that you know that the solution is self-similar, putting that as an answer to your equation and end up with a system of equations that is much more simpler now, and now you can extract an analytical solution that prescribes what's going to happen with the system in general. And I can give you several examples as we go along. Okay, so the way, or at least at the formal level, every time you want to get a solution, you're going to have to deal with these three steps. You're going to have to worry about the complete mathematical specifications of the partial differential equations that you're trying to solve. That includes initial and boundary condition. And wait, let me just contrast with what you could do in some of the other ways of finding a solution. So for instance, again, the perturbative approach. You're saying, okay, I want to know how these small perturbations behave. And because you're doing things, quote unquote, in pencil and paper, you can always imagine you put the boundaries so far out that for all intents and purposes, you don't care about the boundaries. The best you're going to say, oh, I'm going to assume that these perturbations will decay as 1 over r as r goes to infinity. And they really don't need to know precisely how it decays because the boundaries will never enter in the problem. In this way, we're going to have to put a boundary. The boundary will be there. And unless we know precisely what we want to do, we're going to be starting with a problem that is ill-defined. We need to know what we're going to specify for the initial conditions, for the boundary conditions. Otherwise, we cannot even take the first step. So even when we know, for instance, that the boundary conditions that we're putting are wrong, we need to know how they are wrong and what we're going to do as far as defining them. And these are things that we'll get to know better You'll get to know better what I mean as we go along with the examples. Oops. Thank you. The second one, actually, can I ask you, can I borrow you to, can you pass? Maybe I'll give you this. I can ask you to change transparencies. Thank you. That will simplify things. So that's just specifying the mathematical problem. Once we have this mathematical problem well specified, we need to say this is how we're going to discretize it. This is how we're going to turn something that lives in the in a continuum space into something that lives in the discrete space, because that's what we need to put in the computer. That will require us making some precise choices on how we're going to do the discretization, and we'll discuss this soon. And then after we finish with steps two, we're going to be we would have changed a continuum problem into a discrete problem that requires, at the end of the day, just solving algebraic equations. Computers are extremely good at doing that, and that's what we're exploiting. We will assume, of course, at the moment, but then we'll give criteria in order for you to know where this is the case or not. But at the moment, we're going to assume that the partial differential equations that we're working with has a unique solution for a given initial conditions, and even more, that this solution is well-behaved. That means if I give an initial condition that is very close, arbitrarily close to some other initial condition, let me just imagine that, say this is your, the space of solutions of a given problem, and I choose this is the initial value or the initial conditions that I want to give for a particular solution, and at a later time, say this is the final solution I want to obtain, we're going to assume, and that's this point, that given that initial conditions, there is a unique solution here that at the end of the day or at some time that we care to compute. But we're also going to assume that if we choose some other initial conditions that are in the local neighborhood of the initial conditions I give, the solution I obtain at a later time will also be in the local neighborhood of this one. And how big this say, interval is with respect to the initial interval is something we'll discuss later on. And where this interval is bounded in a particular way will tell us where the system is well posed. All, by the way, all physical systems should be described by this kind of condition. Even systems that exhibit chaos can be proved to satisfy this condition. And this is important for us because numerically, once you specify the initial conditions, you actually never specify the condition you want. Simply because what you put in the computer is a round of approximation to the right solution. Right? The number pi that you put in the computer will have 3.14, 15, whatever, and 16 significant digits. But you know that pi has an infinite number of digits. So rather than being here, you're arbitrarily close, but not right there. So if just put in pi with discrete with a discrete number of digits, will tell you you're never exactly at the point you really want to put. You're somewhere close. And then it is important to know that if you put something that is very close, you're going to generate a solution that is very close to the solution that you really want to get. If this weren't the case, we wouldn't be talking about trying to get a numerical solution. But as I said before, we're going to, as we go along and we go deeper into mathematical analysis, we all come up with conditions for you to even know by seeing the PDE equations, doing some analysis, you're going to be able to tell whether your system is well behaved or not. And this doesn't mean that the physics is ill behaved. So sometimes you can have the physical description being correct, but the PDEs that you obtain from it not satisfying this condition. And this is might come as a surprise that even Einstein's equations that you know are well-behaved have infinitely many ways of writing the partial differential equations where this property will not hold, And there's something that is kind of surprising, but I can tell you that even till the year about 2000, the numerical relativity community, by and large, was using systems that did not satisfy that condition, except that we just didn't know what were the right set of analysis that we had to perform to understand how bad the systems were. They were bad in a very subtle way, and this is something we'll discuss. And we can do, and the same goes true for Maxwell's equations. I can write Maxwell's equations in a different way that will make it completely ill-posed, that will not satisfy these conditions, even though the physics will stay exactly the same. But it will be this realization that if you really study arbitrary perturbations with respect to some initial data, the system can still blow up. The solution can still blow up. And so this is something that one has to be very careful with. But we're going to begin assuming that we are in the right track. Can you go to the next one first? OK, so now let's assume that we start with a system that is well-behaved, that we understand at the analytical or formal level everything we want to do with the initial boundary conditions, and that the system is, as I said, well-behaved. Now we want to address step number two, which is how do we go from a continuous problem into a discrete problem? And there are a bunch of techniques that have been introduced through the years to deal with this question. How do you turn a continuous problem into an algebraic problem? And you might have heard some of these words used before. We're talking in this course about finite differences, but you might have heard finite volumes, finite elements, spectral methods. Has any of you heard of these guys? Okay, so 3 and 4 in particular are regarded as much more accurate, much more refined than the ones that the methods will talk, which will be mostly 1 and a bit of 2. In fact, if you now walk out and say, yeah, and meet an engineer from Waterloo, saying, oh, I just come out from a numerical relativity course and we're learning to use finite difference, you might see this guy smiling. And saying, you guys are nuts. You're using techniques that are extremely old. This we gave away, we don't use finite difference since the 60s. And that's absolutely true. But the comeback is, well, we're doing discovery. You're using these techniques to do discovery. You don't know what the solution is going to be. These techniques, especially this one, is really, really good, really efficient, and really accurate if you kind of know what the solution is going to be. If you have solved a very similar problem before, you understand the solution there and just making a twist over that one. So for instance, engineers use finite elements all the time. They use that to design a car, design a building. But that's because the new building they're designing is not too different from the building they already did. If you don't know what the final solution is, the finite difference techniques are very robust, very intuitive, and by all intents and purposes, you can get any solution you want. It might take some time longer, but who cares? If no one has understood the solution before, and you're going in discovery, this is perhaps the easiest one, and the most intuitive one in some sense. Spectral methods are also really good, are extremely good for linear solutions, are even really good for very smooth solutions. But if you have a problem that might develop shocks or might develop very short-scale phenomena, spectral methods don't work that well. Again, because we're in the discovery phase, you don't know if the solution will generate this short scale. You don't know where a solution will generate these continuities. So it's easier to go here. And once perhaps you understand the problem, you can decide to change it and go in any one of these. OK, sure. They use spectral methods in hydrodynamics only if they are dealing with a regime where the solution is going to be smooth. As soon as you're going to develop a shock, one great thing about spectral method is it gives you this phenomenon of spectral or exponential convergence, and this is something, convergence is something we're going to discuss. But that's true if you are dealing with smooth solutions. As soon as you go into something that is discontinuous, that exponential convergence goes away. You go to a lower first order convergence, and then all the extra work, extra overhead in dealing with the spectral technique goes away. So, so it is true. I mean, you're saying it's absolutely true if you have smooth solutions. But if not, then this goes away. Having said that, I mean, this is matter of current research. If you open applied mathematical literature, people are actively working in trying to see how they could still exploit a spectral method when there are discontinuities. But there is no yet a very robust way of dealing with it. Okay, can you go, any other question? So can we go to the next conference, please? Thank you. Okay, so we basically just discussed this, and our good good properties of finite differences is that they are very flexible. They don't require you to know much or get any good feeling about the solution. You can map any particular domain. They are very transparent as the number of independent and dependent variables that you might have. They deal as good as anything else with non-linearities. It respects locality. If you're dealing with a problem where the speed of propagation is finite, therefore you know that if you're looking, if this is some point of your space-time, and this is some previous surface at some given time where you know the full state of the system, and you're dealing with something that has, with a PDE that has finite speed of propagation, you know that only the stuff that goes in here can influence the solution there, because nothing can, from here, affect the solution there, because otherwise it would have speed of propagation that are much faster than the one we draw. The good thing about finite difference is that it respects the locality of influence of solutions of data with respect to the solution at a given point. It only requires to know just a local domain around the point of interest to produce a solution. And that is very useful, not only at the numerical level, but also at practical levels when you're trying to, say, exploit supercomputers to obtain the solution, because you can be doing something here in one processor and something here at a processor that is 10,000 nodes away from it and not have to worry about what happens in between the two of them. While spectral methods, they need to know everything. So it requires further overhead to do parallelization. Can we continue? Just a few more comments. The good thing, another good property of finite difference is that it, in practical terms, it's going to be very, very easy, and this is something we're going to stress in this course, to obtain a good estimate of the error in your solution. And furthermore, we're going to be able to use that property to our advantage to produce even more accurate solution than a priori one would imagine one would get. But again, these are things that we'll discuss later on. And let's go. We already said all this. Okay, so now we're going to talk about a very particular problem. As I said, we're going to start easy, and then we're going to climb up in complication. So we're going to think of the very simplest possible equation that we can, which is just a one-dimensional wave equation. You might first, I should first say that, we'll explain why we're thinking about the wave equation. So in particular, in the back of our mind, we have relativity. But as I said, that the techniques we're going to discuss will be useful for any equation that you can think of. But let me just now be a little bit more detailed in what I mean by that. Equations in partial differential equations in physics can be divided in a few sets. We have equations that are called elliptic equations. And a prototype equation that shows this property is, say, Laplacian of phi equal rho, which you have solved more than once to try to obtain the gravitational potential produced by some distribution of matter. This is something where any change in the distribution of matter will be instantaneously felt, or instantaneously will determine changes in the solutions everywhere. So that means this one have infinite propagation speed. And by that we mean what I just said. So if you go and kick the sun out of the orbit, if you make it disappear, if you are, I don't know, Darth Vader, you have the dead star and destroy our sun, immediately the Earth will just keep going in a straight line because the central force is no longer there. In general relativity, we know that if you do exactly the same thing, it will take some time before the Earth realizes that there is nothing in there to keep pulling it, because it will take this basically the light crossing times between the sun and us to have the local region around the Earth realize that there is no longer a sun. As a result, so elliptic equations are very common, as I said, but they are not physical in some sense. They are always regarded in physics as the approximation to some other problem that has hyperbolic quality, except that for the time scales you're dealing with, you can forget about variations in time and you only have the variations in space. So we're not going to be concerning ourselves with this one, simply because we're going after more interesting cases. But as I said, much of the basics that we're going to discuss will contain or can be applied here, except that this equation, the good thing is that there are tons of techniques that even before you start, you know you're going to get a good solution having you define the problem in a mathematical consistent way. The worst case scenario that can happen with elliptic equations is that you're going to have to wait a long time to get a solution, but you're guaranteed to get a solution and that solution will be well behaved. So this is they don't in principle pose any problem. There's also, let me just call it diffusion or parabolic equation. And this one is the prototypical example, is the heat equation, where you have the time derivative of, say, the temperature of a given system related for some constant with the Laplacian of the temperature. This is similar to the previous one in that it will always have a good solution. The worst case scenario is that you might have to wait a very long time to find a solution. But this one is going to be very straightforward. And pretty much everything we say for the equations we'll be dealing with will be applicable here, except that all the worries that we might have to be careful with about being able to obtain a good solution will essentially not be applicable here. There are things that we're going to have to worry in the wave-type equations that here those worries are gone, just because this is, in many ways, is similar to the previous one. In fact, one way of solving elliptic equations is turning it into a diffusion problem. The last one, a third one, are these hyperbolic equations. The prototypical example is the wave equation. Let me just write it like this. This one has finite speed of propagations. That means, again, that the solution at a given point only requires knowledge of a local neighborhood to be obtained, to obtain the solution at that given point. These are the ones that are the most delicate for reasons we'll discuss. And these are the ones that we'll spend all our time on. And just one last system of equation, is Schrödinger's equations, which doesn't fit in any of these three categories and is treated in a special way. Okay, so let's, again, consider about the 1D wave equation. And as I said, even though everything we'll discuss will be referred to this particular system, at the very least, the qualitative way that the techniques we'll introduce to discretize the system are applicable to all of them. Some of the issues we're going to be worrying about are applicable to all of them. And there are a lot of issues that we worry here that are not necessarily applicable to the rest, but this, in a way, then is the most delicate system or the most delicate type of equation. And so we're going to be kind of working with the worst-case scenario, and the other ones will be simpler to implement. So as I said before, the very first thing we need to do in order to attempt to get the solution to the problem is to find or describe the mathematical way in which we're going to describe the problem, and this has to be complete. We need to give every single piece of information that is required in the problem to guarantee there is a unique solution that is well-behaved. So we start with saying, this is the equation we're going to solve, the wave equation. We need to say where we're going to solve it. And in the very first step, we're going to assume that we're considering a completely unbounded domain, so it can go all the way to infinity or minus infinity. We need to give, because we don't have boundaries, we're going all the way to infinity, the only thing that is left to define is the initial conditions. And we need to give, for instance, the state of the field at some given initial time, and the state of the time derivative of the field at some given initial time. Incidentally, this is a second order equation. We see second time derivatives here, and therefore we need two pieces of information. This is very much like when you iterated, say, Newton's second law, force equal ma, and you were thinking about trying to estimate where this chalk is going to go to in the air. I need to tell you where the chalk is initially and what is initial velocity, otherwise I couldn't solve the problem. So we need to give two pieces of independent information in order to be able to find a unique solution at the end of the day. We have this quantity C, which is the speed of propagation, and we're going to discuss more. I mean, this is a sufficiently simple example that you already know all these basic properties, but we're going to use it later on to describe a generic way or general way to obtain what the speed of propagations are, which in general are not going to be easy to obtain. And this system now at the mathematical level satisfies all the basic properties that we require. So now let's see what we do at the numerical level. Thank you. So let's go to the next slide, please, this one. We're going to discuss the things with the next one. So we start with this equation, so let me just do it this way. The first thing the first thing I did was to absorb the quantity C in the coordinates. So now it's gone, I have a 1, I can always do that. So let me start with that one. And this we know, and this is something that you must have seen before. If not, let me just introduce it here. This equation can be rewritten the following way. So it's the subtraction of the time derivative minus with the space derivative, the operator, resulting operator, acting on the addition of the time derivative of the derivative along the time and the space direction of the potential or the function phi equal to 0. And this is what tells us that the solution to this problem can be general, can be written, the general solution is a function, let's call it phi, is an arbitrary function that depends on t minus x plus an arbitrary function that depends on t plus x. And this we know simply because if we take this phi in here, when this one acts on the t minus x, that I get a 0. And when this one acts on the t plus x, I give us a 0. So we know that any solution that can be written this way will be a solution to this equation. But the important thing is this, that we find this combination, that t minus x and t plus x is special. This is the concept of characteristics, which again, we'll discuss a lot more about this as we go along, especially in the second week where we deal with now solutions that will generate shocks. Knowing the characteristics will be absolutely crucial in understanding when we'll have these discontinuities or not. But given some, say, t equal to 0, initial hypersurface, where we're going to be defining the initial data we're going to evolve towards the future, we said we had to give two pieces of independent information, and the two pieces of independent information can be seen as what piece of the initial data moves to the right, what piece of the initial data will move to the left, and then at any given point, so I have the right moving characteristics and the left moving characteristics, moving like that. So if I look at that point, I know that the solution at that point is defined by the initial data I gave here and the initial data I gave there, one for the left moving piece and the right moving piece. This understanding on how things move will be crucial, as, again, in the numerical implementation, in understanding how much or how many points do I have to put in space with respect to the points or the levels I'll put in time. again, we're setting kind of a very simple example to try to get the right intuition in doing things numerically. The very first thing I did here was to assume that there was this initial hypersurface that I said t equals 0, at which point I'm going to set the state of the system and then try to find out the solution later on, at a later time. Let me just kind of get ahead of myself to say that this is not going to be possible in a simple way in relativity. Relativity, there is no special notion of time, you know. And so somehow we're going to have to come up with this notion of time so as to say, OK, this is what we know the space-time around us is now. Let's see what it's going to be tomorrow. So we're going to have to introduce further information or further concepts to even make sense of that issue. But at the moment, we're going to assume that somehow there is a way to define some initial time at which point we do know what this field is, and we ask the question, what's going to happen later on? So what we're also going to be interested in is in specifying some initial state and analyze how it behaves in time. So one particularly useful concept is to have initial data that has compact support, so something that is localized, so that we can understand where it moves to the left, moves to the right, or if we see it moving from some initial data to the left and right, then we would understand that our initial data had both left and right moving parts. So one particularly useful family of way of or way of defining initial data is just do it with an exponential, so that this you know that it will be concentrated at x equal to x0, and it will have some width given by this delta. And so typically we're going to be playing around with perturbations or initial data that are governed by this kind of thing so that we have control. We want as much control in initial data as we can so that we can probe different scenarios. Okay, so now that was the basic stuff as far as setting up mathematically. Now we want to now turn what we did into a numerics. So the first thing we need to do is to say, to find out how we're going to turn this into a discrete problem that will give us, at the end of the day, an algebraic problem to solve for. So what we need to do is to replace things that are in continuous term into discrete terms. So here we have three things to worry about. How are we going to represent the function that we're interested in solving, or the field phi? How are we going to represent time, and how we're going to represent space? And in addition to that, then we're going to have to ask a question, given that representation, how we're going to re-derive or rewrite the time derivatives and the space derivatives. So what we're going to assume, again, is that we have these sequences of times, so say t1, t2, t3, and we have a sequence of space points, and we're going to say that the function phi, which is continuous, represented by, say, phi of t of x, we're going to represent it now as a sequence, as a series of function values phi1, phi n, say, if we have n points, at times, say, t1, tm. So we're going to assume, they said, we have both a finite number of spatial points and a finite number of time levels, which will then let us re-express the infinite amount of information that is in the function phi, both in time and space, as just a sequence of values that phi has at different time levels. So we still haven't defined everything. We still haven't said how are these points going to be distributed. We can put them a lot closer here and then the other ones further out. We haven't said what is the time in between these different levels. Some could be very close to each other. Some could be having more time in between of them. We're going to take the simplest possible approach, which is to say we're going to assume that everything is uniform. So we're going to assume that x1 minus x2, or say x2 minus x1, is some space delta x And actually, this is true for all points. We're going to assume that x, say, j plus 1 minus xj for all j's. It's always delta x. And the same thing in time. We're going to assume that time n plus 1 minus time n is some delta t. So we're going to assume that we stack the slices uniformly in time and stack the points uniformly in space. This does not necessarily look like perhaps the most useful way in some problems. So if you're thinking of a black hole problem where you kind of have the intuition that the gravitational field is going to be a lot steeper than if I go infinitely far away from the black hole, why am I putting the same number of points and some given distance far out than close in? There are two answers for that. One is, well, we're going to introduce one particular technique that will let us add extra points if we need locally. But then what we're going to be thinking is that every time we're dealing with a grid, it's always going to be uniform. The new thing is that we are going to allow ourselves to put subgrids that are uniform also in space separated, but we are going to put it where we need it. But the other thing is, well, you guys are sufficiently advanced in physics and mathematics that you can always imagine some coordinate transformation between the coordinate x to a coordinate x prime that has a Jacobian that, of course, has different values close to the black hole and further to the black hole. So intuitively, it's easier to think that the points are equispace. And then if we need to have the distance in between the two of them change in a different way, in between different regions behave in different ways, we can always do it formally with a coordinate transformation. So let us think in the easiest terms first, and then we can always relax that as we go along. Okay, so then we're going to represent this function, now, as I said, by a collection of points. We're going to introduce some notation. So the function phi that before could acquire values in t and x, now we're going to say that the function has time given by tn and say a point xj, and I'm already purposely introducing some notation and putting label, the time label up and the index label down. So we're going to say the function at some given value tn and some position xj has a particular value, and we're going to denote that by phi nj. So this is going to be our notation. Thanks. We're going to, for simplicity as well, begin thinking that we're just in one dimensions, but as you see, there's going to be nothing special about the one dimension, so once you know one dimension, you can quickly go to higher dimensions. We're going to assume this, what I said, that the spacing is always the same, both in space and time, but dt and dx will have to be related in a particular way for the solution to be well-behaved, and this is something we're going to discuss as well later on. So now, I said, we dealt with the first problem. We dealt with discretizing our space. We have a continuous space. We now have discretized it in space and time. There, at each one of the points that represent now our discretized space, we can imagine or we can make sense of the values that the function has at those precise points. And then the next thing we have to worry about is how we're going to change derivatives, how we're going to express space and time derivatives given this framework that we have introduced. And the easiest way to do it is to say, let's assume, at least formally, that the solution is sufficiently smooth. At least if I look for in a very small neighborhood of a given point, I'm going to assume that it's smooth, so I can always make sense of a Taylor expansion around that point. So I'm going to take one point as a, sorry, now the notation, we change phi to u, but so this is the, let's think of the field u. Let me imagine that the function u is well behaved around some arbitrary point. Let's call that point j. And we're going to say that if this value or this function u is representing a smooth enough function, so let me just pictorially do this. Say this is x at some given time, and this is the function u. Let me imagine that that's the point j. And we're imagining that even though we only know of these points, right? We're in the discretized, we're playing a discretized game. We don't know about this smooth solution that is in the background. But of course, our intuition, and this is where we started working on this problem, it was that there was a smooth solution that we wanted to get numerically. And as a result, we're getting these discrete points. So we're going to assume that first that we're doing a decent job so that this u at level n point j is a good approximation of the function u of t of x at that point. And this u of t of x is a good, is a smooth enough solution that I can make sense of Taylor approximations. So I can always say, if I stand here, I can say, well, what is the Taylor approximation of t and x at the point u, say, t0, at t0, or tn, let me just do it, tn xj. This would be u of tn xj, plus of course it's going to be time derivative, or let me just, we're going to keep t, keep the time as fixed. So this is going to be the next, the derivative of u with respect to x evaluated at tn xj times x minus xj plus 1/2, second derivative u with respect to x twice, x minus xj square, etc. So that's something we can always do. And we're going to use this to our advantage to say, well, we're going to evaluate this Taylor approximation at points that are points in our discrete grid. So I can say, well, I take this as our base, the base point for the Taylor approximation, and then I ask the question, what do I get at tn xj plus 1 and at tn xj minus 1? Right, so it's just using this approximation, except that now I put, for x, I put xj plus 1 and xj minus 1. And I also do it at xj. So using that, that approximation, I can make sense that uj is just uj itself, so it's evaluating the point at itself. I do j minus 1 is uj. Now, here we have xj minus 1 minus xj gives us minus h, so we get a minus h. The derivative, the special derivative of u evaluated at the point j, and then the Taylor approximation follows. And the same thing with uj plus 1, we can do that ad nauseum. And now when we say, well, we want to find a way to combine, say, these three, we can add more, but let's keep it in the simplest possible term. We can add, how can we add these three terms so that I end up with a discrete approximation to the second derivative or the first derivative or any derivative in particular that you want? So what we do is just, let's multiply this by three numbers, c minus, c0, and c1, and c+, add them all up, and then say, I want this to approximate the first derivative. So I want this to be satisfied. And I'm, of course, I have a finite amount of information here. I only have three. I cannot pretend that this will give me an order, an accuracy of h to the 10. So let's do a simpler one. Let's just think that we want an approximation that gives us the first derivative with an error given by h squared. So that if h, I make it smaller, it will go down by h squared. So then it's a very simple algebraic exercise to realize that the values that you have to get are this. So you have to satisfy that being 0. Again, can you flip to the previous transparency? So notice if I multiply this by c minus, c0, and c+, and I add, and I want to get the first derivative, then I better have that uj goes to 0, because it's the value of that point. I want to get rid of everything up to order h squared and just have 0 uj times 1 times ux. That will give us that approximation, and then 0 this term again. And so then this gives us the solution. C minus has to be minus 1/2 of h, c0 has to be 0, and c+ has to be 1/2 of h. And this, therefore, says that we can kind of rewrite the derivative, the special derivative of x, as being u of x plus h, if we were assuming that x was our base point, minus u of x minus h divided by 2h. We'll do two more transparencies and then we'll stop. So did you guys see that? And then you can do exactly the same thing for the second derivative. With exactly the same kind of argument, you can say, I'm going to multiply these three by three arbitrary numbers and add them up such that I have the zeroth order term being zero, the first order term being zero, and I get the second derivative. And then I leave this as an exercise. Show that this is the second order approximation to the second order to the second derivative. Hold on. And this is a generic problem, so the generic property. You can always derive the finite difference approximations to any particular differential, any particular derivative, by simply using this arbitrary technique. What it could happen at the end of the day is that have we tried to using these three points to approximate the third derivative, we would have obtained a system that doesn't have a solution. And that gives you a hint, okay, you didn't consider enough points. Add two more points or one more point and get a solution. The other thing I'm going to say is that we could have said, notice what we did. So we're looking for the solution, say the first derivative and the second derivative of this point, and we involve this point, and that point. We involve the three. We could have said instead, let's use, say, this point, and this point, and you would have obtained a solution. What you would notice is that the solution you would obtain in that case is only first order accurate. And also, I mean, gut feeling or intuitively, you're saying, I'm somehow biasing towards the right. Why is that? When the problem shouldn't have any bias to begin with. So typically, unless there is something that prevents us from doing that, we'll always look for the most center way of discretizing things. That's why it's always called center finite differences. You try to center your scheme in as much as you can. That's not always going to be possible. If we had a boundary here, for instance, we don't have points to the right, and then we're going to have to address that issue appropriately. But always try to do it as center as you can. And so, well, let us stop here, because we're going to say a few more things this afternoon. And now this is what we're going to try to solve. What we're going to discuss first is to solve this equation. Now that we know that this equation we can turn into a discrete approximation, because we know how to take, we just illustrated the first derivative, and as an exercise, we know we can get the second derivative with respect to x. So obviously, there is nothing special about x. We would get the same expression if we change x for t, and we can also do that. So we have a way to discretize that. These are, say, the boundary conditions we're going to impose. We're going to be now thinking of a problem that has some domain, goes from 0 to 1. So the next ingredient is to think what we're going to do with the boundaries. So this is what we'll discuss. And then we'll see how to turn this into a set of, or a recipe to advance in time. And then one of the things we're going to have to worry is whether that particular recipe we get makes sense. Not every blind or brute force way following, not every way of discretizing this and choosing the spacing between time and points in general will give you a well-behaved numerical approximation. That's what we're going to worry next. This is how to a priori know whether we are in the right track or not. But let's stop here. What we're going to do after lunch is we're going to come back. We're going to make sure that if your software doesn't work, we're going to install the last pieces that you might be missing. And then get you to learn a little bit about how this program works, the one that will generate the code for you. We're going to do a very simple example. It's going to be exactly this one. And you're going to see how quickly you can come up with the code. And then the main thing I want you to learn is how to use this visualization software, which something is always extremely useful. Is once you get a numerical solution, is to actually be able to interact with it. You bring the solution, you play around with it, and by doing so, you're going to be able to assess what the error of your numerical implementation is, or worse yet, if things are not working, where the problems might be. So this ability to interact directly with the data, actually, in many cases, is the difference that will let you quickly get up to speed and having a numerical solution is well behaved, or waiting forever to fighting with different pieces of the code. If you don't see what you're getting, it's very hard to guess where the problems may be. Okay, thank you.